This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to this Moneybox podcast. What can be done to encourage self-employed people to pay into a pension? And many people hate it, but few actually pay it. Could inheritance tax be raised in next month's budget? But first, as you've been hearing in the news, the government admitted late last night that it knew more than 1.5 million disabled pensioners would lose £200 or £300 winter fuel payment this year. The admission, in response to a Freedom of Information request, came as two leading charities exclusively told Moneybox that hundreds of thousands of disabled pensioners who desperately need the payment will not get it. Disability Rights UK and Age UK say that disabled pensioners often have higher energy bills because of their medical needs, and even if their income is too high to pass the new means test imposed by Chancellor Rachel Reeves, the loss of the winter fuel payment can cause them great hardship. Dan Whitworth has been speaking to one couple who'll be affected. Dan, what did they tell you?
Well, I've been talking to a couple we're going to call Anne and Albert. They're from South Wales, and to help protect their privacy, we're not using their real names. Now, both are in their 70s. Both have heart problems as well as serious life-limiting conditions which require medical equipment in their home. And Anne also suffers badly from incontinence. Now, needless to say, they're both registered as disabled, but because of small private pensions they've got, they don't qualify for pension credit. That means they won't get the winter fuel payment this year, which to them means missing out on a crucial £200 towards their high energy bills.
I have to, as I say, do the washings perhaps several times a day. And having to use a tumble dryer, we've only got a very small garden and we can't hang anything out to dry. So it's a case of using the tumble dryer or hanging it around the house, which causes damp in the house. And then we have to buy
dehumidifiers.
Dehumidifiers and run them to dry the house out. It was about 150 a few years ago for the gas and electric, and now it's well over £300. And financially, well, it's a struggle. We can't go anywhere. We don't do anything.
No, we can't.
It's the choice of between doing the washing or putting the heating on, really. And even at sometimes cooking a proper meal. You can't live without heating. You can't live without food. And you certainly can't live with dirty clothes and sheets, etc., etc. So it's really going to have a great effect on us, both mentally and physically.
That's, God, I don't really know what to say to that, Anne. That's really, never mind that it's difficult to hear. It must be difficult to say. How does that lack of a winter fuel payment then, and the consequences that you just so eloquently described, how does that leave you feeling?
Frightened. Very frightened.
And I say you get very depressed over it. I mean, I should think there's even people contemplating suicide over these sort of things. I mean, we've paid a stamp, we've paid tax, we've paid it all our lives.
It feels as though they're just saying, let's get rid of the old people.
Yeah.
Let's just not give them anything. Cut their benefits as much as we can. and let them die off personally.
Anne and Albert explaining the human cost of the Chancellor's decision to take winter fuel payment from disabled pensioners who fail her means test. Dan, what's the Department for Work and Pensions had to say to you about this?
Well, it told me it's committed to giving pensioners the dignity and security they deserve, but given the dire state of the public finances it's inherited, it says it's right to target support to those who need it most. It went on to say it's protecting disabled pensioners with extra benefits like attendance allowance, disability living allowance and personal independence payments, and that over 1 million pensioners will continue to receive the winter fuel payment.
Thanks, Dan. Well, listening to all that is Caroline Abrahams. She's Charity Director of Age UK. Caroline Abrahams, I mean, tragic that Anne and Albert have to worry and suffer like that. And in the light of that interview, how do you react to the revelation last night that more than 1.5 million disabled people will lose the winter fuel payment?
Hello, Paul. Well, it's a very tough listen, isn't it? And I feel so sorry for Anne and Albert. And I'm afraid we're hearing a lot of other older people saying quite similar things to us at Age UK, and particularly about their fear of this winter and also perhaps of worse to come. And there is a loss of confidence, I think, amongst many older people on very low incomes about their capacity to keep going, and also the extent to which the rest of us actually understand that and are prepared to support them.
Yes, I mean, frightened was the one word that stood out to me from what Anne said. Do you think a lot of younger, healthy people just don't realise the extra cost that age and disability can bring as you get older?
I think if you've seen it or if you've lived with someone in that situation, then you absolutely understand it. But otherwise, it's a life apart, it's a world apart. And we know that lots of people don't want to think about getting older. But, you know, I cared for my own mum with a package of care in our own home for a number of years until she died a couple of years ago. And I can think of the extra cost that we had to pay in terms of fuel. She was bedbound for much of the time. So she had an electric bed, which had to be run absolutely all the time, and a pressure mattress to protect her skin. She was incontinent, so we always were running the washing machine. She got cold. Having the heating on wasn't enough. She had to have an electric blanket as well. And so it goes on. And so I think that's not at all unusual. We have to remember, too, that these days there are a lot of older people living in their own homes who are not at all well, who are coming to the ends of their lives. They're not all in care homes, and they're certainly not all in hospital. And we have to accommodate that and understand that we need to support those people to stay warm and well through the winter.
And of course, if we don't, then they will have to go into care homes, and that will be even more expense, won't it?
Oh, particularly into hospital, I think. I think it's absolute certainty that we will see an upsurge in the numbers of people who are fetching up in the back of ambulances at A&E or having to go contact their GP in an emergency because they can't stay warm.
Now, people over 66 who need help from others with their disability get attendance allowance or a similar benefit, and that can be more than £100 a week, can't it? And that helps them qualify for pension credit. Are all pensioners who could get that aware of it? Are they claiming it?
Absolutely not. If anything, I think it's at least as underclaimed as pension credit is. And yet, as you say, attendance allowance can make a fantastic difference. But as ever, lots of older people haven't heard about it. And you have to put in a claim. It doesn't come to you automatically. You have to fill in quite a long form, which it doesn't ask you about lots of money things, but it does ask you in great detail about what you're able to do and not do. And that does put quite a lot of people off, I think.
Yes, because disabled people like to talk about what they can do and not what they can't do, don't they? And yet it's what you
exactly
can't do that actually gets you the benefit.
Yes, precisely.
What do you see as a possible solution here? Because the government does appear determined to push this through, doesn't it? Well, it has. It's passed the law.
I think given the information that's come out overnight, it's really important that the government has a good think about how credible its position now is. And I do think it's important that the Chancellor brings forward some measures in the budget at the end of October to support people like Albert and Anne, who otherwise are looking forward to a really grim winter. And I think we all need to worry about the literally hundreds of thousands of people who are going to find themselves in that position this year.
Yes, and of course, anything they do, anything the Chancellor did do, they'll the government said it's not going to, but we'll see if it does. That would cost money. That would eat away at the savings. I mean, do you not see that as important? The government says it has to save this money.
Absolutely. And we're not disputing for a minute that the public finances are in a very difficult place and that the government has a big and difficult task sorting them out. But surely we should be asking people with the broadest shoulders, as the politicians often say, to be paying more, not people like Albert and Anne who really can't afford it.
And one final thing, there will be some of those 1.5 million disabled pensioners who won't get it, who actually don't need it. And a lot of them write to me and say, I don't actually need this money. How do you react to that?
I think that's right. There's such a great difference within the older population and indeed across our whole society between some people who are very well off and are fine and others who really are not in that place at all and are going to struggle. And the problem with the government's policy is it's taking too much away from that group that's going to struggle.
Caroline Abrahams, thanks very much. And you can claim pension credit 0800 99 1234 on Monday. And if you've been affected by any of the issues mentioned in this piece, a list of organisations that can help is available at bbc.co.uk/actionline. Only 1 in 5 people who are currently self-employed are making contributions to a personal pension. That's the finding of a new report from the Institute for Fiscal Studies. That figure stayed much the same for over a decade, and it says on present figures more than half of all those who are currently self-employed would have no extra pension in retirement on top of the state pension, making life very hard indeed for them. Moneybox listener Ed is a cabinet maker. He's been self-employed for much of his working life. Now in his early 40s, he told our reporter Joe Krasner that he tried to sort out a pension when he was younger but struggled to do so.
I found the whole thing really quite confusing. I couldn't find a product at that time that fitted what I wanted to do. The money is very variable. Some months you will get a huge amount of money in and other months you won't get much in at all. So I was looking for a product whereby I could pay large amounts of money to my pension at the end of the year rather than on a monthly basis. So I didn't do anything.
And what's your situation now?
I have found a product I'm really happy with. I put in a small amount every month, end of the each financial year. I'm then putting in a much more substantial, putting somewhere between sort of 3,000 and 8,000 away annually. That changes year by year, depending on how good the year's been. The only downside is I didn't do it 5 years ago. That's hindsight. I really do wish that I'd set it up as it's set up now, because, you know, I'd be able to reap those rewards in the future.
Do you think it's harder to sort out a pension being self-employed than if you were employed?
I think it is. I think so, because you end up having to do a lot of the legwork yourself. And just trying to find relevant information that really out there, all in one place, which just talks through the different options of being self-employed and that kind of thing, I found that quite difficult.
That was Ed speaking to Joe Krasner. With me in the studio is Vix Rodwell. She's the director of IPSI, a membership organisation for self-employed people. Vix Rodwell, Ed really shows the difficulties, doesn't he, facing self-employed people, variable income, products that are hard to find, advice that makes it seem quite difficult. Is that why few people actually do put money into a pension?
It is. It's unfortunately, it's very, very common from what we hear across the board. I think, like you say, it's the onus is put on the self-employed people, whereas the government's made it much easier for employed people with, automatic enrolment. A lot of people put it on their to-do list, never get around to doing it. And I think the point that he touched on about the variable income is a really key part to this, that if people don't know what's coming in each month, how do they know what they want to be saving towards the end of life?
Yes. So, I mean, is his idea a sensible one? You might put a bit in regularly every month, but he puts a big lump in when he does his self-assessment form at the end of the, well, after the end of the of his tax year. And that's when you know what you've got. And, of course, putting in that lump sum brings down your tax bill, doesn't it?
It does. And a lot of people do it. It's very common. But again, you've got to remember to do it. You've got to be quite disciplined. One of the things we try and encourage people to do is look at the entire year. And, you know, if you don't know what your income is, at least try and identify an amount that you would be happy to put away each month so that it's always in your psyche of, a good good behaviour to do.
Yes, and you've got to put a bit away for tax as well. You do. There's a lot to do when you're self-employed, as I know all too well.
Yeah.
Now, Ed told us he did get advice, but initially he just gave up. He found it complicated, and he'd lost these vital 5 years, because, of course, the sooner you start, the better. Yeah. Can the advice you get be off-putting? Because financial advisors like quite wealthy people, don't they, really?
They do. It is an area that I think people are a little bit scared of. There's sometimes still quite a lot of jargon, and, you know, a lot of time you'll speak to a financial advisor and they don't quite give you the answers that you want. You almost want someone to tell you what to do, but they don't do that. I mean, it's something we're very aware of. We actually built into our membership that all of our members get free consultations with advisors to try and break down those barriers and just sort of put it in plain English what they could do. And, you know, ideally just give them that nudge towards actually doing it.
And the problem with the pension, some people who are self-employed see, is, well, when it's in there, I can't touch it till I'm 55, 57 in the future. What other choices are there that bring some sort of tax relief, but you can actually access if there's an emergency?
Yeah, I think it's a key point. I mean, ISAs obviously are one option that you can get different types of ISAs. Some, you know, you've got instant access, and others that, you know, you can tie it up for a few years. I mean, there is the lifetime ISA that was brought in, but I mean, we've been lobbying the government on that to actually extend the age limit on that, because at the minute it's 40, whereas we think it should be closer to 55 for people sort of having that cut off. Because many people who are self-employed don't actually start working as self-employed till they're older anyway.
Now, the Department for Work and Pensions told us that it welcomes this Institute for Fiscal Studies report, and it will consider its findings as it reviews pensions and improves retirement outcomes. The IFS makes a suggestion that there should be some kind of almost like auto-enrolment with self-assessment. Do you think that's a good idea to really, not force, but really, really encourage people to save?
Yeah, I mean, we support the two suggestions that were made in the report. So one was allowing people to make an active choice about the level of contribution they wanted to make, or bringing in a form of auto-enrolment through self-assessment. I think both of those are quite sensible, but the key thing is keep it flexible. Allow people to opt in 1 year, opt back in, you know, in and out as they need to, and just make it not be a penalty for using it.
Extra well, Ipsy, thanks. And I suppose just do something is the
just
key point.
Just do something, yes.
Okay, thanks very much, Fixed Rod well, Ipsy. Now, inheritance tax is often called the most hated tax, but it's also the one fewest people pay. Less than 1 in 20 estates are liable for it, and just 33,000 are expected to pay it in this tax year. But the amount brought in and the number of people is set to rise. Latest figures show the government received a record £7.7 billion from inheritance tax in the 12 months to July, and that's over 5% up on a year earlier. And the tough decisions we keep being warned the Chancellor will make could include changes to inheritance tax when Rachel Reeves presents her budget at the end of next month. So this week, as part of our series on where the Chancellor might raise taxes to plug that black hole she's talked about, £22 billion, we're looking at this controversial tax. Now, although, as I said, few pay it, many are concerned about it, as some shoppers in central Manchester told us this week.
It's creeping very slowly. You don't appreciate. I mean, when we bought our house, it was 20,000. A recent revaluation. Yeah, it's putting us into inheritance tax.
I think it's probably fair because the minority of better off people pay it.
I'm being affected by it right at the moment, actually, yeah. We're all waiting for it to happen, I suppose. It's not really what my mother and father wanted, and it feels like a lot of it's going to be taken away from us, and that's what wasn't their intention.
Parents, grandparents that I'm potentially going to be impacted by inheritance tax for, so the thought of it being hiked is not a pleasant one.
Well, listening to that is Dr. Arun Advani, Professor of Economics at the University of Warwick. So, Arun Advani, why do so many more people fear inheritance tax than actually pay it?
I think one of the things that people don't always recognise about inheritance tax is that although the headline kind of tax threshold is, well, you pay nothing on your first £325,000, and then in principle there's a 40% rate above that, there are a couple of very big things that are important that mean that threshold is in practice much higher. So the first thing is that if you're married or civil partnered, then the two of you share your allowances. You get two allowances. You get £325,000 each. That's £650,000 as a couple. On top of that, you're also allowed £175,000 each towards a house. So if you each have that and add that to everything else, that means your total allowance, if you have a family home that you're going to pass on to your kids or grandkids, means your total allowance is £1 million before you start paying any inheritance tax at all.
Yes. Because
that means the actual practical threshold is much higher than people, I think, initially recognise.
Yeah, so if you're married and you pass it all to your spouse or your civil partner, there's no tax at all.
But
when
at all.
The second person dies, you get those double thresholds. And that can make £1 million. Now, that confuses some people. And I'll just play you this from Jerry. He's one of our listeners, and he sent us an email. This question from Jerry now.
My question is, what does the £1 million comprise? Is it purely the matrimonial home, or is it the entire estate? And if it is the matrimonial home only, what are the implications for downsizing?
So a number of points there, I suppose, Arun. Just tell us again how you get to £1 million, and what if you do decide to sell that expensive house and go move into a small bungalow?
Yeah, so there's £350,000 that's explicitly set aside only towards the main family home. And then the other £650,000 can be anything. So if your house is worth less than £350,000, you won't use up all of that special bit, but you can use up all of the rest of it. But £350,000 is only on the home. Everything else can be any assets you have. And if you want to downsize out of a home, that means that you'll go below that £350,000. That's okay. There is a special relief called downsizing relief. It's a bit complicated. So if you're using it, make sure you get kind of specific advice to make sure you're using it appropriately. But you can downsize and keep the relief. You just have to have the right paperwork in place to do that.
Yes, I mean, very important to get advice from someone, because this can save you a lot of money, or save you a lot of anguish too. Right. What might the Chancellor be considering to raise more money from inheritance tax?
I mean, there are a few ways to raise more money from inheritance tax. One is to increase that 40% rate. That would probably be a bold move, I suppose one might say.
That's 40% on top of whatever the threshold is, yes.
So 40% on whatever's above the threshold.
Yeah.
The other way to do it is to reduce the actual thresholds. That could be by getting rid of the rate for houses, the special £350,000 as a couple, or reducing the headline kind of threshold, that £650,000 as a couple. But probably more likely, if there's going to be reform, will be some of the reliefs that are quite often criticised. So the kind of three big ones are business property. It means that if you have assets in a private business, or if you own shares in a particular market, the AIM market, those are completely tax-free. 100% of that is tax-free. And so you can have, you know, £10 million or £100 million. It would all pass on tax-free. Agricultural relief, it's very similar, but it covers agricultural properties. If I buy up some agricultural land, even if I'm not actually the one farming it, I can pass that on tax-free. And the third one is an unusual one, but actually is more common to your typical listener here, which would be pensions. You can pass on your pension entirely tax-free if you're passing it on to your kids. And that's important because, you know, we tend to tax incentivize a lot. You know, we heard earlier about pensions in the last two elements, but pensions we tax incentivize to try to encourage people to save for their old age. It then seems odd to say, well, actually, we'll give you a special tax advantage if you pass that pension on. And so I think limiting or removing all of those reliefs seem like things that are likely to be on the cards. And if you were to do that, you could raise kind of certainly above £1.5 billion, which is the amount of money the Chancellor's just been trying to save from this winter fuel payment that was
yes,
discussed at the top of your story.
And briefly, are these loopholes for wealthier people only, or might changes affect what the Prime Minister has called in the past working people, in a word?
Those kinds of changes are aimed at the very top end. I don't think they're things that affect most people. The pensions one is the one that's most likely to affect the kind of more normal listener you'd have here.
Dr. Arun Advani, thanks very much. And there's a guide to inheritance tax on the moneyhelper.org.uk website. We've had an email from Julia who says about pension credit, reminding us that if people have substantial housing costs, they can get it, and they can get housing benefit perhaps as part of that, and also if they have service charges, I think. So, you know, always try and apply if you're over 66 and hard up. Well, that's just about it for my first podcast after the summer. But time to remind you, there'll be more in next week's podcast on the choices of Rachel Reeves and just who they might be tough for. Subscribe to Moneybox on BBC Sounds to make sure you don't miss one. You'll also get Moneybox Live, of course, with Felicity Hannah, which looks in more depth at one topic. Next is the finances of fostering. Where does the money come from to provide a home, food, clothes for a fostered child? And every day you can email us with all your hopes and fears about money, moneybox@bbc.co.uk. We do read them all, and you might get on the show. In this podcast, the team was Dan Whitworth, Catherine Lund, Joe Krasner and Emma Smith. Studio manager was Lewis Main. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now, a bit of politics.
I was definitely too young when I was leader of the opposition, not to do many of the other jobs I did in government.
Admissions and insights from the people who shape how we think.
I would say my family, well, gave myself and my two siblings a critical eye.
And because it's not just politicians who mould our lives, we also hear from economists, comedians and best-selling authors.
It's the fastest way to change things. You do need politics, but if you want to change something overnight, culture is the quickest way to do it.
Conversations, not newsy interrogations. That's Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Was ist noch besser als ein guter Plan? Die Möglichkeit, ihn zu ändern. Mit integrierter KI bietet Workday kontinuierliche Innovationen, die Ihnen helfen, agil zu bleiben, egal was passiert. Workday, the finance and HR system for a changing world.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.